You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, many people consider the ice cream truck to be a classic icon in a hot American summer. We'll talk to our guest about the history of the ice cream truck and the nostalgia that goes along with it. First, tomorrow's Election Day here in Wisconsin. Democratic voters will decide which of eight candidates will face Governor Walker in November, assuming he survives his primary challenge, as is expected. Republicans will vote on what's become a contentious race for U.S. Senate between Marine veteran Kevin Nicholson and State Senator Leah Vukmir. The winner will take on Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin. Millions of dollars in outside money have poured into the race. Just last week, the pro-Nicholson PAC, Solutions for Wisconsin, launched a TV ad that attacked Vukmir for comments she made in March of 2016, critical of then-candidate Donald Trump.
Leah Vukmir got a big laugh when she attacked Donald Trump.
He's offensive, but he's offensive to everyone. He's offensive to women. He's offensive to men. He's offensive to little people. He's offensive to fat people. He's offensive to everyone. I mean, he offends everyone.
She sounds like Hillary.
He's offensive to everyone. I mean, he offends everyone.
If you think you can trust Leah Vukmir to support President Trump, the joke's on you. Solutions for Wisconsin is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Vukmir later endorsed Trump after he won the Republican nomination and has defended him as president. About a month ago, the group Wisconsin Next PAC rolled out an ad in support of Vukmir. It called out Nicholson for his pro-abortion stance while he was president of College Democrats of America and features a clip of him speaking at the 2000 Democratic National Convention.
President Trump needs an ally he can trust in the U.S. Senate. That's not Kevin Nicholson. Nicholson on Life.
We care about a woman's right to choose.
That's pro-choice.
A woman's right to choose must be protected.
Kevin Nicholson addressed the Democratic National Convention.
The Democratic Party shares our values.
Kevin Nicholson, we can't trust him. Fortunately, there's a consistent conservative running for U.S. Senate, Leah Vukmir. Wisconsin Next PAC is responsible for the content of this effort.
Nicholson has said he's become much more conservative since then and that his ties to the Democratic Party are well in the past. So how do these PACs work? Who's funding them and what effect have they been having on the race? Eleanor Neff Powell is an associate professor of political science at UW-Madison. She's an expert on Congress, political parties, and money in politics. Eleanor, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, when you tally up what the Republicans, Nicholson and Vukmir, have spent, and the Democrat, Baldwin, plus the outside groups, $37 million so far, the most in the nation, I guess, for a U.S. Senate race. What's your reaction to that? Is that surprising?
It is and it isn't. It isn't surprising in the sense that this is one of the most hotly contested races. You know, Tammy Baldwin, the incumbent, is running for re-election in a state that's been going Republican the last several election cycles. So on the one hand, that makes it makes sense that it would be an expensive race. But on the other hand, we're not that expensive a media market. So typically more expensive media market states tend to have more expensive races.
Now let's key in on this Republican primary. I don't know if people expected it to be this contentious and to have this much money coming into it. We'll look at each of the candidates in a bit, but I don't think Republicans were planning to lay out that much cash before they were running against Tammy Baldwin.
No, and I think they wish that they weren't. It's expensive and sort of wasteful relative to, you know, all the money they're going to need for the general election race.
And then Nicholson is being backed largely by one person, a businessman named Richard Uihlein. The Journal Sentinel says his groups have spent over $10.5 million in this race. Is this common that for a Senate race we'll see one key donor put that much money into it?
It's very unusual to be able to trace money back to a single donor, and he's doing this through a number of ways that skirt campaign finance limits. You're only supposed to be allowed to give just a little over $2,500 to a primary election race, but he's giving it through these outside groups who then spend the money on Nicholson's behalf. So that's how he's skirting the campaign contribution limits.
How much has this changed in recent years with Citizens United and I think the McCutcheon and other rulings? Is that having the impact now on this kind of spending we're seeing?
Yeah, we've seen over the last several years a number of court cases that have sort of limited or expanded campaign finance rules, but there have always been sort of creative donors and candidates who have found ways sort of around the existing rules, and we're just seeing an amplification of that in 2018.
And then Leah Vukmir is being supported by Beloit billionaire Diane Hendricks, among others, plus the Metro Milwaukee Association of Commerce. Can you talk about the money going in on her side here?
Yes, she's also benefiting from outside money, but as far as we can tell so far, it's a lot less outside money. So she's getting the help, but you know, she's getting help, you know, to the tune of, you know, $1 million, $2 million, and so it's, you know, much less than Nicholson has.
Does this kind of spending, does this kind of money and the ads it buys make a difference in what voters do and don't do when it comes to Election Day?
Well, money certainly isn't everything, and the candidate with the most money isn't the candidate that always wins. It depends a lot on how the money is spent. You know, just like with your own personal spending, you know, you can spend the money wisely, efficiently, reaching out to sort of voters strategically, or the money can be sort of frittered away. And one of the challenges with money coming from these outside groups rather than controlled by the candidate themselves is the candidate isn't allowed to have any control or influence over how that money is spent. So the candidate's really dependent on these outside groups targeting the money efficiently in ways that actually help the race.
On the other hand, does that allow some kind of deniability if these outside groups are the ones, say, running the more negative attack ads? The candidates can say, well, I don't have any control over that.
Exactly. It gives a perfect plausible deniability because legally they aren't allowed to have control over that. They can issue public statements about, you know, what they wish the group may or may not do, but they're not allowed to have any actual control over the money spent. So typically we see a lot of negative campaign spending through these outside groups.
And when we talk about the media, it seems like it's harder and harder. If I want to reach a bunch of voters, I don't know where to put my money because we don't all watch the same shows. There's not just three or four broadcast networks. There's more and more cable. And then people are getting away from cable, so there's internet and social media advertising. Is anybody keeping up with how to efficiently spend money to actually contact voters?
It's really hard, and it really depends on the nature of support that the candidates have. So different candidates, their viewers, their supporters watch different types of media, and so you need to really know your potential supporters pretty well to have a sense of the best way to reach out to them. And it's really tough to tell how these candidates are spending the money. You know, there's been great reporting talking about how much money has been spent on their behalf and some of the TV ad buys, but we don't know about, as you mentioned, digital spending, social media spending, et cetera, all of which could be important. And we don't know whether that's happening. We just don't know about it yet, or if there isn't as much, if they're not investing that way strategically.
Yeah, one thing that's got to make your job a little harder looking at campaign money is that a lot of times we don't know how the money was spent or even how much money was spent until after Election Day, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, this is one of the frustrating things about the current disclosure rules is that essentially the money doesn't have to, most of the money is spent in the last, you know, few weeks leading up to the election, and that money doesn't have to be reported until after the election. And so, you know, a couple of weeks from now, we can have a better conversation about what was and wasn't spent on the candidate's behalf. But right now, it's really difficult to know. We're sort of dependent on, you know, great reporting and sort of little bits and pieces we can find out here and there.
Talking to Eleanor Neff Powell, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Madison, looking at money in the U.S. Senate race here in the state, the primary and the general election. And Eleanor, we've been talking about, okay, big money going into this Republican primary. The incumbent, Democrat Tammy Baldwin, has racked up a lot of cash since she first got elected, right?
Yes, yes. She's so far in this cycle has raised over $21 million.
Is that common for a Senate incumbent?
Well, Senate races have been getting more and more expensive. It's common for what was expected to be one of the most hotly contested races going into the 2018 cycle. She's a vulnerable Democratic incumbent. The Democrats need to hold her seat to have any chance of taking the majority in the Senate, and so this is going to be a tightly fought race.
Are you expecting to see this be, in the end, one of the more expensive Senate races in the country? It's a key race. It's not the only one.
Yes, there are a number of high-profile races, and a number of those high-profile races are in more expensive states with much more expensive media markets than Wisconsin is. So it'll be interesting to see how it stacks up in the end. It'll also depend on how close the polling is once we finally see who the Republican nominee is.
How much campaign money these days goes into, I guess, what I'd call old-fashioned politics, getting volunteers or staffers, training them, knocking on doors, that kind of thing?
Well, it changes a lot, not just election cycle to election cycle, but candidate to candidate. Different candidates invest in different strategies. Some think it's better to sort of work on the local money to get out their local voters. Others feel like they need the TV and the social media ads to reach people. So it's difficult to say sort of there's not like a one-size-fits-all strategy to how people tend to spend their money in modern races.
Now, we've been talking about money that we know where it's going. We hear things about dark money where money is donated to an issue advocacy group who then might run an ad that doesn't say vote for candidate X, but ask candidate X why they're so terrible, something like that. Is that going on, and is that something we will know or ever know where the money came from?
That's a challenging question. You know, there are lots of these sort of outside groups through, you know, super PACs, through nonprofit organizations, 501c organizations, that have sort of more protected disclosure rules where they don't necessarily need to reveal the identity of their donors as much. And so we may be able to trace the money, you know, to the group, but we may not be able to trace the money to actual individuals.
And I should ask, we talked about some of the sources of money for the Republican candidates. How about Senator Baldwin? Are there common themes that emerge when you look at who is donating money to her campaign or in support of her campaign?
Well, she's raising money from a lot of different sources. You know, as one would expect, you know, for, you know, a high-profile incumbent, you know, she has, you know, some large groups supporting her, but, you know, she has a pretty broad range of sort of support from a variety of sort of Democratic and liberal groups.
As we start to wrap up, what are you going to be watching for when it comes to spending after tomorrow's primary election?
Well, I think one of the things that we're going to be looking for is, you know, trying to see, you know, who the Republican nominee is, but then sort of how they're going to be spending their money, you know, what sort of strategy they're going to take to take on Senator Baldwin. She, at least right now, has a lot more money in the bank and has raised a sort of a lot more money, and she's been leading in the polls fairly substantially. If she maintains a substantial lead in the polls against a challenger, once the challenger is known, it might be more difficult for the Republican candidates to raise the money, given how many hotly contested races there are. It'll depend sort of whether this race remains in that top tier or whether this one looks less competitive some of the others nationwide.
We'll leave it there for now. Eleanor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Eleanor Neff-Powell is an associate professor of political science at UW-Madison. She specializes in Congress, political parties, and money in politics. Talked to her about the role of third-party spending in Wisconsin's Republican primary for U.S. Senate. First, if you grew up in a big enough community, chances are you may recognize this sound immediately. While those chimes come in different melodies, the tinkling sounds pretty universal. It's the sound of the ice cream truck. The ice cream truck has survived decades of changing economies, shifting populations, and different trends in America. Our guest says there's something to learn from the iconic American vehicle and its history. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have memories of the ice cream truck showing up in your neighborhood? Did it immediately summon you outside? And even if you didn't grow up with that, does it still seem like a cultural icon to you? And do you still go out and get ice cream at it? Call 800-642-1234. Addison Del Mastro is assistant editor at the American Conservative. He wrote a piece called What the Ice Cream Truck Teaches Us About America. Addison, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, what set you to thinking about the ice cream truck?
Well, it was summer, and I wrote in my article. I live in a suburban town out in Northern Virginia where we've got these trails, great trail system through the forest. But they cut through the housing developments as well. So I was walking through the forest, and I heard through the trees, I heard one of those ice cream truck jingles. And I couldn't go grab it because I didn't know quite where the street was. But I hadn't heard one in quite a few years, honestly. They didn't have them in my hometown growing up because I was out in too rural a place to even have them. But on Long Island, where my grandmother used to live, I used to have them. And I was saying in my article, part of it is almost a collective memory that somehow I know that's a part of American culture. And I almost feel like I grew up with it, even though I didn't entirely. But
I'm the same way. I grew up on a dirt road. I'm pretty sure the ice cream truck never came. There were like five kids on a like half-mile block. They would have been wasting their time. And yet I still feel like it was somehow part of my childhood, even though it couldn't have been that much. So how did it get fixed as this nostalgic thing in American culture?
Well, I mean, it actually goes back quite a long time. I was reading, obviously, about the history of it. And as early as the turn of the century, in the early 1900s, you had these trucks, which actually started out more like carts in New York City. And immigrant entrepreneurs mostly were doing them. ice cream was a luxury good at that time, and these guys started it more as a, you know, a common man, you know, snack, or whatever you would have called it. And that sort of evolved into the ice cream truck. And I, one of the most interesting things I read was that Prohibition really helped the ice cream truck take off and helped ice cream become a mainstream food. Because when they banned alcohol, basically people needed a new vice, and that vice turned out to be ice cream.
That's great. And how did it spread? You know, as you say, it started as this immigrant entrepreneurial cart phenomenon in New York City, but it seems like it must have spread with the rise of suburbs, because that's where I think of the ice cream truck really showing up.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm sure that early California probably had these things. New York is where it started, but you had suburbia, you had, you know, the end of World War II, you had the interstate highways, and so the history of the ice cream truck sort of charts the economic history of America and the development of the country. And, you know, one of the points I made in the article was, if you go back to the 40s or the 50s, this was a new technology. The refrigerated truck, it didn't exist a few decades ago. Even the ice cream sandwich or the Good Humor bar, you know, those were new ideas. You had ice cream a long time ago, but you didn't have the ice cream sandwich necessarily. So at that time, America was still developing economically, and these were things that sort of popped up along the way. And it really hasn't changed in quite a long time. If you look at what they serve these days, what the truck looks like, the music it plays, that was sort of set in that period of industrial innovation, and it's kind of been the same ever since.
Talking to Addison Del Mastro, assistant editor at the American Conservative. He wrote a piece on the history of the ice cream truck and what it teaches us about America. To your calls now at 800-642-1234. Andy is with us in Hubertus. Andy, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I remember the ice cream truck when I was a kid. It wasn't a truck. It was like a three-wheeled, I'm not sure if it was a motorcycle or the guy pedaled it, but it reminded me of, like, the cops used to have these three-wheeled motorcycles, and on the back he would have this, you know, cooler packed with dry ice, and it didn't play music, but he would either, there was a bell fixed to the unit, or he would actually have a handheld bell. But I'll tell you, once you heard that bell, you came running back home, get some, you know, a few cents, and then running back out and hope to catch him before he passes your house. And just brings back a lot of fun memories for sure.
Andy, thanks for that call. And Addison, I was looking at the comment section under your article, and I'm guessing you've heard from a lot of people when you bring up the ice cream truck. A lot of people probably have these memories like Andy did.
Yeah, absolutely. But actually, one of the interesting things, ice cream wasn't the only truck that people brought up. One guy, or I mentioned in the article, actually, a knife sharpening truck, which apparently is a thing that existed and in some neighborhoods still does. I've never seen one. But another guy mentioned in a comment that there's a pizza truck that comes by his neighborhood, and that for generations his neighborhood has been, you know, ordering from this pizza truck, and I've never seen that either.
Me neither. But there's something about... There's something about the ice cream truck, Addison, the ice cream truck, a lot. I don't see those knife sharpening trucks. We don't get the milk delivery, you know, in the glass bottles anymore.
Right.
The ice cream trucks are still out there.
Yeah. I don't know why that particular trend survived, although, as I know, some of them have become sort of upscaled. Now you've got, instead of sort of the traditional ice cream truck, you've got food trucks, but, you know, sort of a little bit of hipster culture, and they're serving you, I don't know, lavender honey ice cream for $8 or something. And as far as I'm concerned, that's not even an ice cream truck. That's not the same thing.
I think lavender is a smell, not a flavor myself. So talk a little more about what looking back at the ice cream truck teaches us about America, as you say in your piece.
Well, I mean, it teaches us that Americans like our sugar. It teaches, you know, it's true, you know. off topic, but I just got married this weekend.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. And my wife happens to be from China, and I give her American desserts. I have ice cream and cake and stuff with her. And she tells me that in China they don't have sweet desserts. The desserts are barely sweet. So when you think about it, it might actually be strange for someone in a different food culture to see ice cream trucks. Well, you know, people can really eat that kind of sugary stuff, but we love it. And we replaced alcohol with it, as I noted about Prohibition. But and I guess there's also, as you noted, it's tied up with suburbia, which in some ways is a distinctly American, you know, development pattern. That's something I think about when I'm not writing about ice cream or a brunch or something. I wrote about that once. I'm writing about suburbia and, you know, urban planning and zoning and stuff. I've written about a lot of that. And so there's an extent to which something like the ice cream truck arises out of the way that we build our environment. And I can't really get into that too much, but these things are connected, and that's an interesting thing to think about.
I want to bring on another caller real quick. Rod is with us in Green Bay. Rod, hi.
Hello. This is so interesting. Both my father and my uncle, it was called Dean's Ice Cream. They ran trucks mostly out to the rural areas, going farm to farm, where they sold ice cream and food goods. And, but, you know, also into the suburban areas. And I know my dad always had an open box of, like, ice cream sandwiches or whatever the kids wanted, popsicles. And, you know, he'd ask for the 15 cents, but if they didn't have it, hey. it just brought back so many memories, this show that I'm listening to. And they were known, as the ice cream man, you know.
That's fantastic, Rod, and we'll leave Rod with the last word. Addison, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
I've been talking to Addison Del Mastro, assistant editor at the American Conservative. He joined us for a look at his piece called What the Ice Cream Truck Teaches Us About America. Now, 50 years ago today, African Americans and Latinos marched together in Milwaukee to protest discriminatory hiring practices. It's the first time both communities had joined forces to fight for a common cause. And our next guest says the march sparked years of activism among Latinos in Milwaukee and around Wisconsin. Activism that led to big gains, things like better working conditions, bilingual education in Milwaukee public schools, and higher Latino enrollment at the UW-Milwaukee. Jesse Garza is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jesse, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, you covered this 50th anniversary of the protest in depth. Can you set the stage for us? What was life like for Latinos in Milwaukee and on Wisconsin farms back in 1968?
Well, in 1968, I was going on 14 years old, so my knowledge of what life was like at the time is limited to that of a 14-year-old. But from what I could remember, you know, most of the kids in my neighborhood, we grew up poor. Our parents worked in the valley, in the tanneries, and in the meat packing plants. Those of us who came from two-parent homes or who were fortunate enough to have one or both parents employed. So I guess in a way, we weren't really aware of where we were at in terms of the social ladder. I can tell you that from what I've learned, you know, growing up, is that migrant farm workers were facing very harsh conditions at the time, even though there were laws covering migrant farm labor on the books. They were not being enforced, and they were subject to barracks conditions. Jesus Salas told me that for a while his family stayed in a factory that had been converted from a cannabis production facility, because I guess cannabis was a material that was used during World War II, and that after the war, this facility was converted into a barracks, and that's where his and maybe a dozen other families might have been staying during one season in Wisconsin. There was also no enforcement of the minimum wage laws pertaining to migrant farm workers. There weren't any toilets in the field. Child labor laws were being ignored. Salas himself spent 10 years in some very strenuous stoop labor beginning at age 7. And housing and medical conditions were way less than ideal for those workers. So migrant farm workers in Wisconsin, many of whom, if not most, were either Mexican-Americans or Mexican immigrants, we're really living under some very tough conditions.
And you write in your reporting, talking to people involved in Milwaukee protests in 1968, you know, while a lot of the nation was involved in protest and different communities were, it sounds like Latinos in Milwaukee were seen as not political, not active until these protests. What started to change that?
Well, I think what started to change was when people became aware of the migrant farm workers nationally. In the mid-1960s, Cesar Chavez, who would later go on to become, you know, a renowned figure among Latinos with respect to the civil rights of migrant farm workers, he began organizing the United Farm Workers in California, and they eventually launched a national boycott of table grapes. And they were fighting against the same conditions that were faced by migrant farm workers in Wisconsin, many of whom started having ties to family in the Milwaukee area. So when people like Lalo Valdez, who's mentioned in the story, and Jesus Salas, and Ernesto Chacon, when they became aware of the struggle of farm workers out in California and nationally, they began to relate that to the struggle of migrant farm workers in Wisconsin, thousands of whom were of Mexican descent and who would come up from Texas and other areas of the South in the mid-1960s to work in the cucumber fields, in the in the pepper productions, or in the food processing centers, the canneries, during the summer months. So it was when they became aware of that movement that they connected it to issues faced by Latinos in Wisconsin at that time, mainly the plight of migrant farm workers.
Talking to Jesse Garza from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about his reporting on the 50th anniversary of pivotal protests in the Latino communities in Milwaukee and then around the state. And this pivotal protest you write about, the Allen Bradley March in 1968 related to job discrimination, set the stage. Tell us how it happened, what came together.
Well, first of all, Valdez and Chacon and Salas met each other at the offices of Centro Hispano, what's more commonly known as the Spanish Center, which in 1968 was located on in the 500 block of West National Avenue. The director of the Spanish Center, a gentleman, a Catholic priest by the name of Father John Maurice, he had established Centro Hispano with a $6,000 grant from the Milwaukee Archdiocese. And it was set up primarily to focus on the needs of migrant farm workers and Latinos who were coming to Wisconsin and who needed help with either health services or food service, any type of assistance. So Father Maurice allowed Jesus Salas. Once Jesus became connected with the United Farm Workers, and if I could just back up for a second, while Salas was organizing farm workers in Wautoma, he reached out to Cesar Chavez and he asked if they could fly the banner of the United Farm Workers during a march to Madison that Salas had organized with a group that later became Obreros Unidos, or United Workers. They would later become the first certified migrant farm workers in the state of Wisconsin. He reached out to Chavez and he asked if he could fly the UFW banner during a march from Wautoma to Madison that demanded enforcement of existent migrant farm labor laws. Chavez not only granted his request, but he sent an organizer out to help Chavez in his efforts. In return for Chavez assisting in the national table grape boycott for the United Farm Workers. So after that, well, the march to Madison, you know, the way Salas puts it, it ended up in a lot of handshakes and promises of goodwill and enforcement. And it wasn't for years after that, after more protests demanding enforcement of these actions, that an actual division of migrant farm labor was established within the Wisconsin Department of Industry, Labor, and Human Relations. So when Chavez came to Milwaukee to organize the Great Boycott, he was allowed to set up in the offices of Centro Hispano, where earlier UMOS, United Migrant Opportunity Services, another grassroots organization that was run by a number of church groups, they had established themselves at Centro Hispano. So you have UMOS, whom Ernesto Chacon ended up working for when he came to Wisconsin to work on, well, he came to Wisconsin in 1959, but he didn't become involved with migrant farm workers issues until he began working for UMOS. So you have Chacon at Centro Hispano, you have Jesus Salas at Centro Hispano, and you have Avalaro Valdez, who at the time was a senior at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and who was just, you know, getting his first taste of activism on campus with the anti-war protests at the time. He was a recreation aide or playground supervisor at the nearby Vio Elementary School playground, where he met a young community organizer from the Spanish Center named Hollis Stewart. Hollis recruited Valdez to work in one of the education programs at Centro Hispano, and Valdez was already interested in community organizing at the time. So he met Salas and Chacon at Centro Hispano. They became involved in organizing efforts. And one of the first issues they became organized around, or they targeted, was the discrimination at Allen Bradley.
And that's where we'll pick up the story in just a few moments. Jesse Garza is with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about his reporting looking back at Latino activism in Milwaukee and around Wisconsin 50 years ago. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you there? Were you part of this organizing taking place in Milwaukee and in farming communities around the state in the 60s and 70s? What are your memories of it? Are you a Latino yourself? Have you participated in organizing efforts then or now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Jesse Garza. He's a reporter whose recent piece on the 50th anniversary of Latino protests in Milwaukee tells the story of a big change, a pivotal moment in Latino politics in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a memory to share from that time. Okay, Jesse, you set the stage. You laid out the players for us. Now take us to this pivotal march. What happened?
Well, Father Grappi and the NAACP Youth Council Commandos had just completed almost a year-long series of marches, open housing marches in Milwaukee, and they targeted Allen Bradley with a complaint that went to the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission alleging discriminatory hiring. At the time, Allen Bradley had about 6,500 employees, about 50 of whom were black or Latino. I believe there was like 30 African-Americans and 14 Latinos working at the Allen Bradley plant at the time. So Grappi planned this protest march on Allen Bradley, and he approached some emerging activists at Centro Hispano. He was also a friend of Father John Maurice, so they knew each other. They actually grew up together in Milwaukee. So he, out of respect, he brought this idea to Father Maurice that they intended to march through what was largely a Latino neighborhood at the time, and also to ask to invite those emerging activists to participate, among them Valdez and Chacon and Salas. A meeting was held at Centro Hispano on, I believe it was August 11th, and the march was planned for the evening of the 13th.
And what was the response to this march as people from the Latino and African-American communities joined together to protest these allegations of job discrimination?
Well, a lot of the Latinos in the neighborhood, or a lot of Latinos, you know, in general at the time, they, you know, they were subject to a lot of the same inequities or mistreatment that black people faced in Milwaukee. Latinos, were largely lived in an area in what's now called Walker's Point, and as kids, you know, even though, you know, we went to an elementary school that was largely Latino, but in high school, you know, the Latino kids had their own cliques, and though we generally got along with the Anglo kids, outside of school, you know, you were taking a chance if you ventured outside of the neighborhood of either being targeted with racial slurs or some kind of physical intimidation. So at least the kids in the neighborhood, you know, our sympathies leaned toward the commandos who faced a barrage of bricks and bottles and racial slurs during the open housing marches the year before. So the greeting was quite warm. Once the Grappi's group crossed the Sixth Street Viaduct, there was a lot of handshakes and warm greetings and sort of like a united group, united for a common cause, more or less.
And what was the response from employers like Alan Bradley and from the leadership of the city of Milwaukee? Was this something that put the Latino protests here on the map for them?
Well, I'm not sure about city officials, but the Milwaukee Journal, you know, much to their credit, they and the Milwaukee Sentinel, they covered those marches and the entire Alan Bradley issue extensively until a year later. Well, Alan Bradley denied that it had discriminated against anybody, despite the numbers at the time. And after a year, there was a federal ruling that found that Alan Bradley did not discriminate against African Americans, though its hiring practices did tend to leave out African Americans. So it was sort of a fuzzy ruling that didn't say anything about Latinos, but the bottom line was that they were found not guilty of job discrimination. And of course, you know, Alan Bradley was later bought by Rockwell International, which eventually split into two separate companies, and the plant down there is now Rockwell Automation, and it's a completely different company with a completely different outlook when it comes to a diverse workforce. But it wasn't as though the Alan Bradley officials leaned over backwards to accommodate those demands.
Talking to Jesse Garza from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about 50 years ago in Milwaukee and around the state, the rise of Latino protests in the state. Jesse, let's start to talk about the long-term impact of what started that day and with those farm protests as well. What kind of things started to change?
Well, like I mentioned before, subsequent marches to Madison, many of them led by people from United Migrant Opportunity Services, did result in the creation of the Migrant Farm Workers Division in the Department of Industry, Labor, and Human Relations. But at the same time, there were fewer migrant farm workers due to growers and processors moving to avoid union contracts after the Obreros Unidos Union became certified. So a lot of these people began coming to Milwaukee, and that led to a completely different change within UMOS. UMOS became more of a job training and employment program, even though at the time it was still focused on migrant farm workers. And of course, today it's a multi-state, you know, agencies that provides employment and job training toward all low-income people. The same people who took part in these early in this early activism, they later created the Latin American Union for Civil Rights that became involved in other issues that were affecting Latinos at the time. One of the big issues was bilingual education. With a large number of Latinos in Milwaukee public schools either coming from Puerto Rico or from Mexico and with limited English language skills, there was a movement by a lot of these early activists for the establishment of bilingual education programs in Milwaukee public schools, and that led to the creation of a bilingual, bicultural citywide committee within Milwaukee public schools and the establishment of a vast ESL program and bilingual education program in Milwaukee public schools. At the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, Valdez, who was a senior there in 1968, stated that there were only a handful of Latino students among the, I'm going to guess there were at least maybe 30, 35,000 students enrolled at UWM at the time. And so in 1970, the Latin American Union for Civil Rights, or LAUCR, became involved in or organized a series of demonstrations that led to the takeover of the chancellor's office at UWM and eventually the establishment of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Spanish-Speaking Outreach Institute, which today is the Roberto Hernandez Center, named after one of those early activists. Today, out of approximately 25,000 Latino students at UWM, about 10% or around 2,000, slightly more than 2,000 of those students are Latinos. And there is a movement by the university to establish themselves as I can't remember the exact term, but is a Hispanic-serving learning institution or university. So to attain that, they'd have to hit a 25% enrollment. So not only is there more Latinos at UWM, but there's also an effort by the university to increase Latino enrollment. And I think more than anything else, from my conversations with the sources for this story, the protest at Allen Bradley awakened a consciousness among Latinos that led not only to direct action, but activism itself. Lupe Martinez, who is currently the president of United Migrant Opportunity Services, you know, he talks about an activism that not only takes place in the streets, but, you know, in the voting booth, in the boardrooms, within city government.
And that's a good place to leave it. Thanks to Jesse Garza, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with us to talk about the Allen Bradley Company protests in Milwaukee 50 years ago today that led to years of activism in the Latino community. You can follow his reporting in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.